Right now it is time for the Media Beat with David Tarachuk. David joins us on a Friday morning. He has his own terrific website called themediabeat.us. He's also a PBS television correspondent reporting on ethics and belief. And we love to welcome him in on a Friday morning. Good morning, David.
Well, hello. It's good to be back with you from the media capital of the world, New York City.
That's right. You're back from the great wide open spaces.
Yeah, they couldn't fence me in, but they could get me back. I had to come back to my home base in the end. And, you know, the home of the national TV networks, the commercial networks, and indeed to some degree the home of PBS as well, much of PBS, but mainly the commercial center of the media world here in New York City. And speaking of those networks, I have to start, I think, this week with something of a bad taste recollection. There was in the advertising industry a mock ad created in the 1970s when the American motor industry was so concerned about Japanese imports, Toyota in particular, and they created this mock ad for Japanese cars saying, "From those wonderful people who brought you Pearl Harbor." I'm not going to say it's anything as bad as that, but I felt about NBC that their so-called town hall with the president last night was a case of, you know, for that particular network, the slogan, "From those wonderful folks who brought you The Apprentice," was inevitable in coming up to mind.
You know, the whole thing about this is that it's bad enough that a debate didn't happen, even though it's probably a good thing for us all. But when ABC announced their setup with Joe Biden, NBC has every right to try to counter-program, but not in the true interest of the public. If it was in the true interest of the public, it wouldn't have been at the same time. It would have either been before or after or even the next day. And I think a lot of the anchors on MSNBC, I know of four of them who displayed displeasure by the way the whole thing worked out, because it was clearly and correct me if I'm wrong, David, but because Donald Trump has such a close tie with the network because of the show that he hosted for all those years, it just looked like the network currying favor to the president to put on when Joe Biden was on. And I think that was this was the whole horrible part about it. It was just a ploy to get a bigger audience with Trump voters when Joe Biden was on. That's all it was.
Well, it certainly was a case of the optics were not good. It did not look good. It's as simple as that. As you say, it's the same network that brought you The Apprentice, had a lot to do with Trump becoming a household name beyond the boundaries of New York City here, where previously he'd been. He had a certain reputation. But he sort of played the part of a successful business mogul and on that show, and then thus became a national figure, giving him something of a launching pad right from the beginning of his ambitions to become president. It's unclear who approached whom, whether it was NBC who approached the Trump campaign, or I think more likely that the Trump campaign approached NBC to come up with some kind of alternative once there was clearly a regret in the Trump campaign about Trump refusing to do the virtual, the online-only remote situation that was suggested for debate number two, because, of course, he was suffering from symptoms and tested positive for the virus. So he was a COVID patient. So on that count alone, the Commission for Presidential Debates felt it wise to go for the remote version of a town hall. Quite how it would have been organized is unclear, but Trump's typical reaction, of course, was to say that he wouldn't do it. It was a, quote, waste of time for him. When the possibility of the NBC thing came up in its place, for the Trump side at least, of course, Trump would regard it as, you know, he said quite clearly out loud in so many words. He said, I figured, what the hell? We get a free hour on television.
Yeah.
Well, that's exactly what it was. That particular quote is a rare bit of truth-telling by the president, considering that he's a man who, on average, utters 13 falsehoods a day since he's been in office. I don't know what to say about it overall, except that it doesn't pass the smell test for objective campaign reporting and campaign platform providing, which is normally what you would expect of what you rightly described as a public service during an election campaign. But that doesn't appear to be what the way that NBC was regarding it. To not so much the mounting of the debate, in the sense that that's perfectly defensible under various arguments, but to counter-program it directly, head-to-head, even in the days of time-shifting at home, an awful lot of American homes, of course, have various capacities for time shifting what they view, but that requires a certain kind of political dedication to watch both programs. And of course, a much more public service-minded way of programming it would have been to put it on at different times, and that's not what happened. However, whatever criticism we may have of NBC, and I think there's a lot to be voiced here, I should say that the actual execution of the program was in some ways like a breath of fresh air. Savannah Guthrie was a moderator that we've been waiting for, I think, in some sense. It certainly made a very welcome change from what we've been seeing lately. What we had last night was an effective and an incisive questioner, both in her own account and in that case, what she's doing is acting for the audience at home, a tribune of the people, as it were, a spokesperson for us asking the questions that we want to know, and, you know, shepherding the questions from the attendees at the town hall, and following up when an answer was being evaded but needed to be answered. She didn't get an answer every time from the president, of course, but what she did get was all very telling, and she did not let him bully her. Although he was clearly very testy about the experience, obviously didn't enjoy it for one minute. But it was a service to the public, I think, to have, as I say, for for once in this dismal run of presidential debates this year, a moderator who was forceful and incisive.
You know, before I went to bed, I watch TV differently. When I watch something on cable that I pay for, I watch it all the way through from beginning to end. But I am a
you want to get your value for money? do you get it?
When it comes to the rest of TV, I'm a person that watches for 2 or 3 minutes and then switches over. So what I did is I watched probably a total of about 2 or 3 minutes of the Biden show, and then I watched probably about 2 or 3 minutes of Donald Trump.
Probably enough to get the flavor of both. Huh?
It was exactly what I expected. Joe Biden is a low, calm, key person, does not give short answers, gives long answers, and because he's a seasoned campaigner, in those answers to questions, he manages to put his platform pieces in there as well and expand upon. And also, when when he spoke to people at the end, he said, you know, he did the stuff that it's like kissing a baby on TV. I hope I answered your question. To the one kid who was a black kid who was questioning his vote on the crime bill, when he finished his long answer, he said to the kid, if I didn't answer your question correctly, after the debate's over, after this program's over, come and see me and I'll try to answer it. I'll try to clarify my question. And on the other hand, you got Donald Trump. You got what you saw on The Apprentice. You got what you saw, what happens every day. It was about Donald Trump, the person, not about Donald Trump, what's in the future. And Joe Biden did it. Joe Biden, what would be in the future? And it's just the way the two people are. They're cast in stone. They're both in their 70s, and they're never going to change what they do. And that's what focused to me in the short time while I watched both of that events. And then I went to bed.
Well, I think you did your duty. But yes, the way that they related to their respective audiences and town hall audiences in that convention of an American town hall question and answer session was very telling. Certainly, very little respect from, I would venture to suggest there was no respect from the President of the United States towards these citizens of the United States who were asking him questions. Biden was a different case entirely. He was maybe, you know, like a good politician, was laying it on a little thick, saying, "I hope I answered your question," but I shouldn't be unkind about that. I mean, it, especially when you cite the contrast. I mean, he at least was taking account of the fact that there were real human beings there asking him a question and expecting an answer. On the other side, on the NBC side of the coin. The discontent he felt, I mean, it's just the discontent he always feels, I suppose, that's the truth of it, came through very clearly. I mean, it was classic Trump as victim. Three times over, he repeated the same line, "They treat me very badly." And in this case, he was talking about, in this particular passage, he was talking about the IRS, but he could have been talking, as he often does, about anybody, everybody, the whole world, perhaps. They all treat me, Donald J. Trump, very badly, and that's a regular chorus line of hers. I was interested in what you said about the MSNBC anchors expressing some degree of disquiet about how their overarching network NBC were at fault in creating the occasion in the first place. Well, it was interesting to see a review of this whole issue by CNN's media correspondent, Brian Stelter. He referred to some people among the critics, the chorus of critics, who've been down on NBC for the Trump show, as he called one category of the complainants working journalists, and I was intrigued by that phrase. There's been no comment by NBC News itself, but he said that working journalists were making it clear that they disapproved of what was happening from on NBC's part. But the description "working journalists" was interesting. I mean, I guess he meant, and I like the differentiation. He meant working journalists, opposed to those journalists who are yelling at each other with their opinions on cable TV or on talk radio. It's a distinction that I'm going to try and make myself in future. There are working journalists, and there are those performing journalists that we have far too much of on air.
Yeah, and like I said, Joe Biden did the old-fashioned kiss a baby routine. They both spent the 90 minutes deflecting, more deflecting than answering, but Joe Biden just did it in a quieter, classier way. But basically, there was a lot of deflection that went.
And indeed, some substance. Yeah. I mean, it was interesting that Savannah Guthrie's efforts to get him to disavow QAnon, that that wild, extraordinary, well, I say wild, it's an internet community on the wilder shores of conspiracy theory, I suppose, casting Trump in the role of some heroic champion fighting against the secret so-called deep state, who, among other things, are supposed to operate rings of pedophiles. But he was forced to make a comment on it, and he didn't disavow it at all. In fact, he praised QAnon for being against pedophilia, as if this was some kind of campaigning organization for the public good. So I think, you know, that certainly tells us something important about Donald Trump, that he's perfectly capable of taking advantage of some of the insanity that goes on amongst his craziest followers.
You know, and on the other side, from what I saw this morning, I didn't actually see it unfold, all this hubbub above will Joe Biden, if he wins, stack the court? And I try to tell everybody that I see that, ladies and gentlemen, if Joe Biden wins the presidency, holds on to the House, and wins the Senate, you're damn right he's going to pack the court. it's just a...
that is what presidents do. I mean, some try it in extreme form, like
Franklin Roosevelt.
FDR, yeah. Roosevelt, and in his case failed because he overreached. But yes, every president wants to get, if the opportunity comes up, and if not, you know, in this case, you can perhaps create new opportunities for getting sympathetic justices onto the Supreme Court. That's just a given. However, you know, how skillfully or how, you know, responsibly, I suppose, is what we're talking about. Whether it's done responsibly or not is the question that lies in the future. And of course, the inevitable thing is that the inevitable long-term outcome, of course, is that it will just become a ding-dong, and each time the occupant of the White House changes, there will be a rush to get new justices onto the bench. Yin and yang and yin and yang as time goes on. But he made it pretty clear that he would be reviewing things in the light of how the current nomination goes. I mean, I think we know exactly how it goes, but I think he means how the whole treatment emerges in political terms. The whole treatment of the issue emerges in political terms, and that's a reasonable position for a politician seeking high office to maintain. And you know, at least now he said what he means. He's going to think about it, which is a reasonable thing for a thoughtful politician to do.
All right. Now, I want to move away from those folks for just a second and go back to COVID-19, and that is what's going on in England. More and more of that state is going to a top-tier alert on COVID-19 because, like it is in the United States and like it is elsewhere, it is on the rise again.
Indeed. My old hometown for my teen years of Manchester, England, has now been brought to full shutdown status, much to the annoyance of the mayor there, who is saying that this is, of course, damaging to the economy of the city. Now, this Labour, a socialist mayor, by the way, who's saying this, so it's not a matter of capitalist self-interest, financial self-interest. He's concerned about the community of Manchester. London, too, is not yet at that point, at that level of restriction. But clearly the Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, has been thinking aloud about that, and it seems very imminent that London might well come into that fiercest restriction category. It's all evidence of what the British media are seeing, rightly I think, as a lot of prevarication by the Prime Minister. Like many countries, and indeed like our own country here in the United States, there's an upsurge of COVID again, sometimes localized, sometimes widespread. In Britain, they're trying to localize it in terms of response, and it gives Boris Johnson the opportunity to not do anything especially dramatic nationwide, which he thinks would damage his standing in the country as a whole, which has slipped dramatically since the sympathy vote, in a sense, that he got when he was ill himself. In fact, many people are making direct comparisons between the two country leaders, Johnson and Trump, who themselves fell victim to COVID and the different response the public has had to the leaders getting the disease and then, to some degree at least, coming out recovered. That may be a questionable statement. I'll leave it on the table for a while.
Now, I will go back to the NBC town hall with Donald Trump, and what I saw on video this morning was astounding and not really hammered upon by any of the analysts, and that is, I'll give Guthrie, she kept pushing him on the $400 million loan, and he finally admitted that he did admit that he does owe $400 million, but then, of course, the tangled web, it's not who he owes it to, it's just a small portion, it's leveraged, it's this and that, but he did go on record after he said that all those claims in the New York Times article were false. He did go on record basically admitting that, yeah, he is in debt for $400 million.
Yeah, and he also tried to dismiss it as a mere peanut amount. Well, I'm not sure intelligence organizations would agree with that analysis. That's a lot of money to owe whoever he owes it to. If he owes it to Russians, then of course, here we go again with the concern about him being open to pressure. And of course, who wouldn't be under pressure if they owed $400 million, even if they might think it's a peanut value?
Well, I think, you know, you just brought up something that I have. Hey, listen, we've all gone through times in our lives where we've owed money and we haven't had the money to pay, okay? I don't think there's very few Americans or people in the world that haven't been in that position. But what people don't understand is it's not how much you owe, but it's who you owe it to and what your station is in life. If you are a policeman and you happen to borrow $1 million from a bank and you have to default on that, that's one thing. If you're a policeman and you borrow $1 million from a mobster, it's a totally different thing. I mean, this is...
It's a clear and obvious point you make, but I think it needs to be underlined. You're right. I mean, this individual we're talking about is the chief executive of the country, and he's in his companies that he owns that he refuses to disassociate himself from are in debt to these extraordinary eye-watering amounts of money. It can't be brushed off, or at least, well, I hope it can't just be brushed off either as a peanut amount or as something that doesn't raise important security issues. It clearly does.
And I do have to say that even his supporters, it had to raise eyebrows for people out in Western Pennsylvania and in like West Virginia.
Well, anywhere that doesn't have a ready $400 million at hand. Yeah, sure.
I'd be even bet you there's lots of people on Wall Street that it raised their eyebrows.
Oh, I know people on Wall Street who are appalled at the idea of, there are lots of ways of leveraging the amounts, even as large as that, we know. But many a financial manager would be tearing his hair out right now.
And the final thing in our final few minutes, well, first of all, do you have somebody you want to tip the cap to in the media, first of all?
You know, I was thinking about our fanfare. I thought it's almost worth it for Savannah Guthrie this week because she did do a very good job. But I'm afraid it's only because the baseline has been brought so low this week. Journalism, once again, is not distinguishing itself. Okay. The man who would have been chairing that town hall, if it had happened, the way that it had been planned with both candidates, Steve Scully from C-SPAN, the chief political correspondent, was caught out doing something really, really stupid. First of all, asking, do you remember the wonderful Scaramucci, the former spokesperson for a media advisor for Donald Trump, who is now so active and vociferous on the Biden side? Scully sent him a tweet asking his advice for how to handle Trump, who is bad-mouthing Scully. And then, because this didn't look good, he tried to tell the public that his Twitter account had been hacked. That sounds rather familiar as a defense, doesn't it? Well, he finally had to admit that that was a lie. And journalists who lie about anything, but in this case lying about how they conduct their own efforts to improve their own image or defend their own image in public, that's just another, yet another, I'm afraid I have to say, another sad day for serious journalism. I'm just not in the mood. No, I shouldn't say that. I'm taking it too personally. But I don't think it's appropriate for us to be blowing bugles of fanfare for journalists this week. I'm going to say that Savannah Guthrie did a pretty damn good job last night.
Well, we could put this sound effect in.
That's not a bad one for this week.
All right, and very quickly, the new allegations against China and what they're doing with Muslims has flared up again.
Sure. Well, I mean, that's never going to go away until a day that's not likely to happen, which is that China might change its ways. Yes, the Muslim minorities are, of course, always on the end of official opprobrium, and there are these education camps, re-education camps, as they euphemistically call them, and this story is just rumbling and rumbling, and it's never going to go away, as I say, and I don't think the Chinese authorities are going to change their ways at all. They might in time, start to think that it's the worldwide publicity about it is on balance harming them more than these minorities that they fear so much. But I don't see it happening. No, we're going to keep hearing more and more about this terrible story.
All right. Well, David, we've got, 18, 19 days till the election, something like that?
That's right. We're down to a real day count now, and it's a serious matter. And I hope we all as journalists and media people take it seriously. And it is a horse race. We often complain that these events are seen as horse races and not as debates about important issues. Well, this is a horse race, and it is also about an important issue. The most important issue, I guess, is whether we trust a particular individual to take us through these very distressing times of severe threat to our public health and in many ways a severe threat to the nation's economy as well. Who is the best steward for our immediate and rather urgent needs? That's the fundamental question, and that becomes a simple choice between two people.
David, we'll speak to you next week.
Look forward to that.
Take care. David Terechuk with the Media Beat here on Robinhood Radio.